90.1 FM, listener-sponsored and commercial-free, where you'll hear less talk and more music. KPFT, your Houston community station.
This is 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston, a Pacifica radio station.
And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices. This week, Brian Levinka talks with David Taffet, senior staff writer for the Dallas Voice and co-host of the Lambda Weekly radio show in Dallas. He was recently diagnosed with Parkinson's disease.
My handwriting had gotten illegible, and as a reporter, when you're covering something, you take notes, and it's important that you be able to read those notes afterwards so you can write your story. And I'm looking at my pad, and it's like, what is that mess? You know, and it was just one thing after another that I was noticing.
And Brian talks with Robert Wallace about the upcoming annual Pride Brunch, June 29th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Deborah Moncrief Bell has a conversation with John Marullo, the author of a book about a political fantasy centering on the Brimmer family. The family includes twins who are gay.
Their two sons, David and James William, when they come out as gay, when they're, I think, about 11 in the book, it's just accepted. There's not even a blank. Originally, Nathan says, well, it is kind of normal for kids your age to question that. They just look at him and say, yeah, we're gay.
And Deborah has a conversation with Elizabeth McCall, who is a storyteller, improviser, writer, producer, and director based at Station Theater in Houston. Queer Voices starts now.
This is Brian Levinka, and today we have a guest from the North, David Taffet from Dallas, to come on and talk about an issue that we have. Welcome to Queer Voices, David.
Thank you.
David, who are you and what do you do in Dallas?
Well, I'm the senior staff writer for Dallas Voice, and I am the one of the three co-hosts of Lambda Weekly, which is a show very similar to yours.
How long have you been doing that?
Since 1990, so 34 years.
And how long has the show been around?
40 years, coming up on 41 next month.
We're friends on Facebook, and I've followed you for a while, and you recently diagnosed with something that could you tell us about?
Yeah, I was recently diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. I was having a series of things that just didn't feel right, and my doctor sent me to get an MRI to rule out stroke because the symptoms were similar to someone who's had a stroke. We ruled out stroke, and so he sent me to a Parkinson's specialist, and the Parkinson's diagnosis has pretty much been confirmed.
And how have you felt about that?
Mixed feelings. I feel good. Since I've been on Parkinson's medication, I've felt a lot better. I'm dealing with it. I've gotten so much support since I wrote my article in Dallas Voice last week that it's surprising. I never knew how much that kind of support really could help.
In full disclosure, I have Parkinsonian symptoms as well. I have a brain tumor that causes that. So I know what you're talking about, the tremors. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you wake up in the middle of the night like I do.
I've been waking up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom more than I've ever done. I thought blood pressure medication made you go pee. Parkinson's medication, it's like once an hour.
Let's talk about Parkinson's and what is it?
My understanding is that what Parkinson's is the brain or the brain cells that produce dopamine stop working. And so you stop releasing dopamine. And dopamine is what gives you flexibility. It helps with your movement, keeps movement less jerky. And Parkinson's medication replaces that.
What was the first thing that you noticed?
Our publisher at Dallas Voice noticed last summer that I was walking without swinging my arms and walking very stiff. That was the first thing that anybody noticed. And I noticed when I was walking that I wasn't swinging my arms. So I tried walking and swinging my arms. And as soon as I stopped thinking about it, my arms went stiff again. But other things started popping up. Like one day I noticed I was shaving with my right hand, and I'm very, very left-handed. I looked at myself shaving with my right hand. I switched hands with the razor. My hand is shaking, and I couldn't shave because my left hand was just shaking so much. So I went, oh, that's not good. Other little things like drying off from the shower. I was having trouble flipping the towel to rub my back to dry myself off. I was having trouble aiming the toothpaste onto the toothbrush. It was ending up on the floor. So it was lots of little things like that. My handwriting had gotten illegible. And as a reporter, when you're covering something, you take notes. And it's important that you be able to read those notes afterwards so you can write your story. And I'm looking at my pad and it's like, what is that mess? You know, and it was just one thing after another that that I was noticing.
Let's talk about the treatment of Parkinson's. What do we do?
Well, the treatment that I got is a drug, and I never remember the name of it.
Semaglutide.
Okay. You take it three times a day. What my doctor said was start with two half pills for a week, one when you first get up, one about noon, one about five. Take it on an empty stomach. And each week we added another half pill till I'm up to three full pills a day. The hardest part of it is it needs to be taken on an empty stomach, and you have to keep your stomach empty while the pill is dissolving. So I get up at about 6 a.m, take a pill, go back to bed for an hour, then have breakfast at 7. In my office, I stop eating at about 10 a.m. so that I can take a pill at 11 so I can have lunch at 12. Same thing at 3 o'clock, stop nibbling, take a pill at 4, and when I'm home at 5 or later, I can have dinner. Is that the dosage that you're on?
I'm on that dosage as well, but I've done other things like Rotari, and I've done the patches, and I've done, because I've had issues with my tremors, and I just don't like the noticeable symptoms of that. Like, I don't want people to ask me what's wrong with my arm, why is it tremoring? So I'm very self-conscious about that.
And I've had people ask me if I'm okay from stiff movements and just even not aware of where I am for a few seconds. My speech, I can be in the middle of a sentence and not be able to get the words out, which is great for a talk show host. What's been working on my show is my two co-hosts have been with me for 25 years, and we're at a point where we finish each other's sentences. So they've been just jumping right in like they always do. I pointed out to them that they were finishing my sentences, and it was like, oh, I'm sorry. And it's like, no. Do that. It's what we always do. And on the air, if I'm having a brain fart, do that so that we can finish, because it's about our guest. It's not about us. Just finish my question, because you know what I was going to ask. But with speech, I've felt, and this is getting better, with speech, I've felt like the words from my brain, getting it onto a piece of paper, no problem at all. I can write a story as fast as ever. Maybe a few more typos, but spell check gets that. But brain to mouth, first sentence usually comes out fine. Second sentence, a little bit stiffer. By the third sentence, if I'm telling a short story, in the middle of the sentence, I almost have to stop, take a breath, and push those words into my mouth.
Why should the gay community care about Parkinson's? We've been so worried about HIV/AIDS for so long. Why should we care about this now?
Because we're getting old. And for those of us who survived the AIDS epidemic, there are all kinds of other things that we need to be concerned with. And this was something that just hit. It's not something that's hereditary. It's not something that is more prevalent in one community than another. As I've been telling my story, I've been hearing from a number of people who've told me they also have Parkinson's, or a friend of theirs has Parkinson's, or a relative of theirs, gay or straight. But we've been so focused on AIDS, and we need to continue to be. We've been so focused on AIDS, we're not worrying about some of those other things that come along. And when my Parkinson's diagnosis was confirmed, I decided, let me tell the story, and it might just help somebody else who's hearing some of these symptoms and encourage them, go to a good neurologist, talk to them about what's wrong, and it could be Parkinson's, it could be another neurological problem, but it's important to have those things checked out.
I think if we can reach one person with symptoms and make a difference in their life, they've done our duty.
Yeah, exactly. I've spoken to several people who said, oh, I have such and such. When you were describing that, that sounded familiar, like maybe I'm having that too. Go get it checked out. The neurologist I went to was wonderful. On my first appointment, he spent almost an hour with me, just asking questions, watching me walk, watching me move, giving me motion tests, and answering my questions. It was a great diagnosis. One thing he said, he put me on the pills, and when I got up to the full dosage, I had another appointment. He asked me, or he looked at me, and he said, oh, you look so much better than you did the first time you came in. And I said, I feel a lot better. He said, well, the medication is working. That's the good news. The bad news is it confirms your Parkinson's diagnosis. Parkinson's medication only works on Parkinson's. So he said, so you have it, because there is no blood test for it. Deb is asking what my prognosis is. My doctor said he's had patients who've done well on the medication for 10 years. After that, it's a neurodegenerative disease. There is no cure for it. The medication won't stop degenerative progression of the disease. So the prognosis is I'll get worse. Hopefully I'll be in my 80s by the time I'm much worse. And hopefully my 70s, because I am 70 now, hopefully my 70s, I'll be able to progress very slowly on the medication. And they're always doing new work, looking into new therapies, and hopefully there'll be something within 10 years.
We need to mention Michael J. Fox's organization that's doing amazing work.
Michael J. Fox was diagnosed when he was 29. He's 62 now. He started the Michael J. Fox Foundation about the year 2000, 2002, something like that. And they've been doing amazing work in research. And you need somebody like that to be out there and testifying before Congress and raising money, showing that it's something that you can live with, but we need more medication and we need therapies that will cure it, make the brain produce dopamine on its own again, or improve the medications that replace the dopamine. So,
okay, on a lighter note, let's talk about Lambda Weekly and where can we hear it and what's the station that it's on?
It's on KNON 89.3 FM in Dallas. You can hear it streamed live at KNON.org. Hit the play now button and the station streams. Usually a day or two after the show airs, it's in our podcast section of the website, which is harder to navigate, but it's there.
We've been speaking with David Taffet of the Dallas Voice and Lambda Weekly from Dallas about his recent diagnosis with Parkinson's. Thank you, David.
This radio program, We're Voices, has existed since the 1970s on KPFT. We have this little crew of folks working every week to produce what's no longer unique because we're almost mainstream now, but we're still an important voice that might not otherwise get heard because it's not on that many places. So KPFT is very important to give voices to those who might not otherwise have voices. So as Glenn always says, you participate by listening. You should also participate by supporting the station. So please go to kpft.org and make your donation right away.
This is Brian Levinka, and today I'm interviewing my friend Robert Wallace about an upcoming Pride Brunch event that's happening in June. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Okay, what is this Pride Brunch and how did it all get started?
I started this event, this is our sixth annual Pride event. So I started the event 7 years ago because of 1 year, obviously we didn't have it because of COVID. But I started it because I felt like there was literally nothing to do on Sunday, except, you know, go to the bars, which we can do that anytime. So I started a brunch 7 years ago. And the first 2 years, it was a sit down brunch at the Federal American Grill, which I thought was appropriate being the FAG. We had the brunch there, it was a sit-down brunch, but I kind of felt like people wanted to get up and talk to everybody in the room. The first year we had 45 people, second year we had 85. Then, of course, the COVID in 2020. And then 2021, we restarted it and did a new location. We started at LaGrange. And both years, we did two more years at LaGrange. And it was more of a, you could get up out of your seat and talk to people and socialize event, which was really what I wanted for people to be able to socialize. So we did that. But the second year at LaGrange, it was 107, 108 degrees outside. And I was like, we have got to find a new venue. So last year we found the Heights Social, which is up in the Heights off 22nd Street. I was curious to see if people would go up to, you know, for brunch there in the Heights. But sure enough, we had 400 people last year. The event raises money for the Mantra Center. 100% of the proceeds go to them. It's a worthy event, and we donate all the money in honor of my uncle who died during the AIDS, HIV epidemic.
How did you increase the attendance from like 40, 50 to 400 in no time at all?
I think part of it's just people keep coming back and people keep bringing friends. The first 4 years is probably a lot of, you know, I pretty much knew everybody there, I knew most people there. Especially last year, we kind of opened it up more to the public, which was always open to the public before. But we started doing, you know, opening it up to more people, advertising through the Mantra Center. This year, we're advertising through Outsmart. So we're hoping to increase attendance. But it's largely been people just keep coming back and they keep bringing back their friends, which I think is the highest compliment.
What is your vision for this? Where do you see this going?
I would like to get us to a place, hopefully next year, where we're raising $100,000 a year for the Mantra Center. Last year, we raised $58,000, which was a record. This year, we're hoping to raise $75,000, and I'm hoping to get it to a point where consistently, without little work, it raises $100,000 each Pride for the Mantra Center.
You mentioned that you dedicated this to your uncle. Can you talk more about that and why specifically the Mantra Center?
First of all, you know, it was kind of when he passed away in 1991, it was kind of a family secret. I was still in high school at the time. It was only until years later, I kind of figured out and put the pieces together. It was like, oh, he died mysteriously, very young, gay. And I kind of put the pieces together and confirmed that, in fact, he died during the HIV AIDS epidemic in 1991. The first year we didn't do a fundraiser. It was just a brunch. And the second year, one of my friends challenged me and said, oh, we should do it as a fundraiser. I was like, well, that's a really good idea. So we raised, without even trying, we raised a little bit of money. And I was like, you know, if we really try and put a little effort behind it, we could probably raise even more money. You know, I just made the donation in his honor. And that's been kind of a nice tribute to him, to my late uncle, by donating the money in his honor. I always pick the Mantra Center. It's just an easy charity for us to support. It's Houston's LGBTQ center. And they really offer so many different services that people that I know have utilized in the past. So there are anti-violence programs, counseling, education outreach. I know that, for example, they help train the Houston Police Department. Their STD testing and prevention, housing assistance, their senior program now that they have, substance use recovery, and their youth services. I mean, it's just a lot of services that the Houston LGBT community need. Perhaps we don't know how good of a center we have here. You know, this center's been around since 1978. It's been around for, you know, a very long time. And it delivers quality programs to our community that many of us probably don't see, but so many people in our community need and take advantage of.
Have you thought about forming a 501c3 as you're getting bigger and kind of growing the amount that you're raising?
There's an attorney who would love to help me with that and donate their time. I think it would be great. I do piggyback off the Mantra Center. So we use their ticketing system, their donation site. All the money goes directly to them. So when you buy your tickets or you make a donation, or let's say you buy a table, all that money is donated directly to the Mantra Center when you check out on our website.
Someone that's near and dear to me is DJing your event. Can you talk about him and other entertainment that you're planning?
I've known Chad, actually Brian, his partner, one of my first friends when I moved here to Houston in 2007. So I've known Brian a long time, and that's how I got to know Chad, obviously. And I didn't know Chad. I did not know him when he was a DJ. He kind of took some time off, I think. And I was like, you know, someday I'm going to have a brunch. We're going to have a location where I'm going to have a DJ. And by the way, and we're going to have drag queens. I was really thinking about that the first year or two. And obviously, when we got LaGrange, they had the capabilities where we could have Chad as a DJ. And so he volunteered his time. obviously. So this will be his fourth Pride brunch. He will have DJed, his fifth in attendance. The Grange was a little tough on him because he was literally, the DJ booth was literally outside in the heat. He really appreciated it when we got a new location at the Heights Social because he could be inside in the air conditioning all day. Chad does a great job, and Chad also DJs another event that I host, which is the Halloween Ball. We work quite closely together on those two events, and Chad does a great job. I'm very proud to have him as one of my partners and hosts in this event.
Full disclosure, I dated him for 5.5 years. What other entertainment do you have at the brunch?
We have two drag queens. We started having drag queens for at our third year event. So this will be our fourth year. This will be the first year, fingers crossed, that we have two drag queens at the same time. Last year, we were supposed to have two drag queens, and then one of them hurt her ankle the night before the brunch. So we only had one last year. But we have two drag queens. One of them is Cinnamon LaRue. And Cinema is a bearded drag queen, and she just won the award for best bearded drag queen in Houston, Lone Star. We're really excited to have her. This will be her first brunch. And then the second drag queen is Lucy Paradisco. I've known Lucy for a while. She was supposed to be our second drag queen last year. She's the one that twisted her ankle. She's promised me that she won't be doing any somersaults or anything to injure herself the night before again. But I'm looking forward to having them both. I think it'll be very entertaining. They believe in the cause. They believe in the Mantra Center, and they're excited about supporting the Mantra Center.
Can you tell us where people can get more information and ticket information?
Go to tinyurl.com/, and it's simply Pride Brunch 2024. There you can get more information on the event. You can look at our sponsorship packages. You can look at buying a table. You can look at buying tickets. We have different ticket and drink packages. Or you can just make a donation, all of the above. So there's more information there about the entire event. Everything you need will be there. We do have an online auction that we start the week before the event and run through the event. And we usually have, I think last year we had about 20 to 25 items for sale on our auction, things that are donated. So if anybody would like to make a donation to our online auction, if your company wants to give a gift card or give some services, or you have something you would like to donate to the online auction, feel free to contact me.
I think we did not talk about the date for the event, so let's mention the date.
Sunday, June 23rd, and our doors open at 11 a.m. People may be out late that night. We used to call the event the Recovery Brunch. Some people still call it that. And it's just kind of a joke because people would be out till 5, 6 in the morning the night before, and then they would show up to brunch at 12, 1, 2 o'clock. So the doors open at 11, but we'll be there till 4 p.m. So it's a five-hour event. People come and go. You can come early, or you can come late, or you can come and stay the whole time. It's up to you.
Robert, you and I are both part of a Pride ERG at work. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, we both work for an ERG. I mean, we're part of an ERG group at Siemens Energy. This year, our speaker, we're going to be doing a panel discussion, and one of our speakers is going to be the CEO of the Mantra Center, Avery Bellew. I met Avery actually this week. It's the first time I met her, and I have to tell you, I'm really excited about the energy that Avery will be bringing to not just the Mantra Center, but to Houston itself. So really fortunate to have a new CEO with a lot of new energy and a lot of new vision of where she's going to take the Mantra Center. So, but she'll be our guest on the panel discussion. She's the first trans CEO of such a large organization, I believe, as well. So that's pretty incredible. And she's just she's going to be an incredible leader and many, many years to come with her.
But going back to the brunch, when is it? Where is it?
It's Sunday, June 23rd. Doors open at 11 a.m. You must be 21 years or older to attend because there will be cocktails and this year mocktails. And it'll be at the Heights Social. And the Heights Social, I got it wrong, is actually on West 20th Street in the Heights. It's just a really, really beautiful place. We used to decorate for the Pride Brunch. The first 4 years here, we decorated. When we moved to the Heights Social, it's such a beautiful venue. A lot of nice neon lights and stuff. And we're like, let's not decorate. It's such a beautiful location. It has a 101-foot chandelier in its lobby. And that's where a lot of people stand and talk. Beautiful atrium, beautiful lobby, hoping that we got our AC issues. It was a brand new building last year, so the AC was struggling to keep up a little bit, but I think they told me that's going to be resolved this year. But just a beautiful, beautiful location and building. there is limited parking. And obviously, as people will be drinking, we suggest that people Uber or Lyft to the location. But it's a really cheap, quick Uber or Lyft at 11 or 12 o'clock on a Sunday.
And before we go, is there anything else you want our listeners to know about you or your event or what you're doing?
People always ask me, how can they help? We definitely can always use volunteers. We need volunteers to work the front desk because checking in, 500 plus people takes a little bit of work. We can also use donations to the online auction, as I mentioned before. Attend, invite your friends, and buy your tickets early. That helps us plan. Early bird ticket prices will end on Friday, June 21st. If you wait till Saturday or at the door, it is slightly more expensive. Just because it's buying tickets earlier enables us to plan for, are we going to feed 400 people or 500 people on Sunday? So that's the question that we're always trying to answer. That's the way people can help. Volunteer, donate, make donations to the online auction, participate, bid on items in our online auction. When that opens, buy tickets, bring your friends. So invite everyone you know.
We were speaking with Robert Wallace, who is putting on the Pride Brunch on Sunday, June 23rd. Thank you for coming on, Robert.
Thank you for having me.
This is Queer Voices.
This is Deborah Moncrief Bell, and today joining me is John Marullo. He's the author of All the Dwellers Upon the Earth, a book that was recently featured at the Houston Public Library as part of their Pride Month celebrations. John, I understand that you're originally from Massachusetts.
That's right. I am a native of Massachusetts. I was born just outside Boston. I lived there till I was 12, and then I lived there again as an adult. And then I've been in Houston for 26 years this fall.
A lot of your career was as a librarian. Was that here in Houston?
Yes, I worked for the Houston Public Library for 23 years. I was able to retire after 23 years there, so I took my pension at 52.
How does one begin to write a book? What was your inspiration to do this, and how did you come up with this idea? Because I just started reading it, and I'm like, okay. You call it the Brimmerverse because it's a family named Brimmer, and they're kind of special.
They really are, in many ways. To start, I decided I was going to do NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month. National Novel Writing Month is a challenge that happens every November. People are asked to write a 50,000-word novel in the month of November. I wanted to see if I could do it, but the real inspiration came on the night of November 1st, I had a dream about a family. The father was a president of the United States, and they were, for want of a better word, witches like on Bewitched. It was very much inspired by that, I think. And I woke up and said, that would make a great story. That would make a great TV show or movie or novel. And then I remembered it was National Novel Writing Month, and that's when it started. And I started writing then. I had no outline, so it was a bit of stream of consciousness writing to start. But I managed to get it finished. I did not win NaNoWriMo that month. I did not finish it in November. I actually finished the first draft on January 6th. I gave myself a little extra time. But January 6th of 2019. It's 2018 that I started in November, and I finished it in 2 months. It has been a lot of fun just rewriting it and reading it, and then finally taking the plunge and publishing last year.
This is the first in a series. Do you have titles for upcoming books?
Yes, indeed. The first is Behold All the Dwellers Upon Earth. The second, which should be coming out this year, is, I have to remember because the titles are in a sequence, and I'm blanking. The title of the second one is We Most Heartily Beseech Thee. And the third is With Thy Favor to Behold. The titles come from a prayer in the book, and an older version of the Book of Common Prayer. There is a strong Anglican Episcopal content part of the book. And the characters are Episcopalians, as I am. And the titles of the books and the chapters are all taken from some version of the Book of Common Prayer. So that's where the titles came from, and that's also where the titles of the upcoming books are.
The book is described as a political fantasy. That's not a term you hear very often. And it centers upon this family, the Brimmers, starting with Nathan Brimmer, who learns later that there's been these powers within his family for some time. And he uses the term witch, but he also, like you, is very centered in the Episcopalian church. In fact, I think you call it high church.
Yes.
So apparently religion not only plays a crucial part in this book, but in your own life. Why did you think that was important, and how do you, I guess, balance this idea of what a witch is with a not just Christianity, but a church that is so steeped in the traditions as yours is?
The word witch is kind of abandoned shortly thereafter. That was what he thought of, and he didn't like the word. And part of it is out of respect for people who are Wiccan and do use that term for themselves. It was the word that came in my dream. So it's like, let's start with that and see where it goes. Ultimately, there is a different name for the people. It is actually not unusual for writers in the Anglican Episcopal tradition to embrace fantasy. C.S. Lewis and Madeleine L'Engle were both in the same tradition. C.S. Lewis was Church of England. Madeleine L'Engle was an Episcopalian also. So we actually have a tradition in our church of going a little of thinking beyond just what we traditionally say. We're kind of an interesting church where, you know, we're the descendant of the Church of England in the United States. We embrace a lot of different ideologies. High church is closer to Catholic. Low church is closer to Protestant. We're kind of the bridge in between. And it is, so it's not really an unusual thing for people in the Episcopal Church to embrace the idea of fantasy and something that's non-traditional, at least in literature and such. In real life, perhaps not, but being open to the idea in fiction is not unusual. A lot of the great fantasy writers, as I said, have been in our tradition.
And I don't say this to offend, but I call myself a witch, but I'm not Wiccan. I come from a tradition of feminist spirituality, and I think there's a hunger among people for the magical. I think that's why shows like Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie and some of the others, we want to be able to transform, which is what magic is really about. And I think that we do transform in our lives, and particularly within the queer community, I think there's a lot of magic that is created.
It's, one of our, one of the things I tried to do, and I, although my characters are traditionally religious, there's not a feeling of proselytizing, because that's just going to turn people off. I want people to enjoy this, and you write about what you know. It was either I was going to write about Episcopalians or librarians, and librarians aren't that interesting to write about, honestly. We want transformation in our lives in one way or another, whether it is through a more conventional religious tradition or a less conventional. The goal of both things is going to be to make your life better and to make the world around you better, to transform it. My characters are a bit more obvious in what they can do, but, you know, we all hope to make the world a better place.
People are seeking to make sense of their lives or make sense of the world. And for many people, that's what they turn to, or they were raised in that tradition.
It is part of my characters that is very much their tradition. In the other books, I kind of explored a bit more, but the family has been in that tradition since the 17th century, when they rejected Puritanism because they saw what extremism was doing. Their two sons, David and James William, when they come out as gay, when they're, I think, about 11 in the book, it's just accepted. There's not even a blink. Originally, Nathan says, well, it is kind of normal for kids your age to question that. They just look at him and say, yeah, we're gay. And that's also one of the things that in the Episcopal Church that we're actually known for is that we were among the first Christian churches to embrace the LGBT community in a way that others don't. It's not across the board, but about 10 Episcopal churches will be marching in the Pride Parade this year here in Houston, for example, including my own, which is Trinity Episcopal in Midtown.
David and James William are twins.
Yes.
Did you have experiences with twins that influenced these characters, or it was just part of your imagination?
It was part of my imagination. David and James William are based on people I know more than almost any of the other characters are. Two friends I met online, Daniel Yatetsky and John Wallace. Wallace is his surname, but he's called John Wallace a lot. And they originally, the characters were actually named Daniel and John Wallace. But I decided I at least needed to give them a little more of an identity. Other characters were named after people, but that didn't really mean anything. They were different people. But they were very much influenced by them. I was in a group chat with them at one time. That group chat no longer exists. But it was the way they interplayed with each other was... They're both very witty, brilliant, ridiculously talented, and they were the kernel for what David and James William became. They are both very well aware that I've written a book, and they actually gave them both signed copies as a gift, and they've both been very gracious about being, for want of a better word, exploited in that way. But they're both such interesting people, even though they're not. They're not brothers in real life. They are friends, and they live in different parts of the country. It just seemed that the right thing to do, and they became very quickly my favorite characters.
The family, in varying degrees, have these special powers, but the twins have it in aces. Their father enters politics, and they know things like before they happen. They know what the future holds in a lot of cases, and they foresee a disaster, and they know that their father can do something about it, that maybe he can prevent it. Wouldn't that be nice?
Absolutely. Part of my writing, it was frustration with the current, as of 2018, and unfortunately still current political situation, where you have certain people who are not good people in politics. I, in fact, don't mention any real politicians by name, even though I do refer to them in descriptions. They see a disaster, which is... someone who was in the White House in our world, and they attempt to prevent that from happening.
If I understand correctly, their father does, in fact, become president of the United States.
Yes, he does.
And was he modeled on anyone in particular?
Not really. There are times when it is mentioned that he reminds people a little of JFK, but he's not JFK and who he is. In most ways, Nathan is a complete fabrication of my imagination, sort of my ideal of what a leader would be, what a politician would be, what a president would be. He is kind, he listens, and above all, he keeps promises. And that is one thing he keeps going back to, is if he makes a promise, he keeps it. He will not promise something. And that is what leadership should be about.
In the books, you explore religious and LGBTQ themes, as well as the importance of both family of origin and family of choice. Can you expand on that?
We've touched on religion and LGBTQ themes. Family of origin, the Brimmer family is a very close-knit family. They genuinely like each other, in addition to being relatives. And I think I would love it if we all had families where... in addition to just being related to each other, we all liked each other. I have three older sisters, and I get along with all of them. And I'll just leave it at that. I get along with all of them. It would be great if everyone could get along. They're a stable family. They do realize that they're very privileged, of course, in both being a wealthy family and also having these special abilities, but they genuinely care as well. Family of choice also comes into play. There are a lot of characters who they sort of adopt into their family. A lot of them are their church people. There's one couple in particular, a couple from Houston named John and George. My husband is indeed named George. So I decided to insert myself in the book as well. Might as well do it because everyone does. And they just sort of adopt them into their family, and they make them feel, even though they don't have anyone nearby, that they're a part of who they are as well. So that, I think there's a whole lot of that, particularly among queer people, because very often people don't live where they grew up. They have a lot of friends who grew up in small towns. They came to a large city because they knew they'd be accepted. And they find their communities where they do. And I've often found mine in church settings, but there was one point where I was regular in a bar, and that was a family of a sort at the time. So there's a lot of idea that people who are closest to you may be the people you're related to, or they may not.
This is Deborah Moncrief Bell. We've been talking to John Morolo. He's the author of Behold All the Dwellers Upon the Earth and additional books that will soon be out as part of the Brimmerverse. You can find more information at brimmerverse.com. And John, thank you so much for being with us today.
This is Queer Voices.
This is Deborah Moncrief Bell. I'm talking with the zany folks over at the Station Theater. Station Theater is an improv company, and they're doing shows every Saturday night during the month of June with the theme of, guess what? Pride. And I'm talking with Elizabeth McCall, who is one of those people that wears a lot of hats. Elizabeth, what are some of the hats you wear over there?
I do everything from tech to writing, directing, producing, acting, if I can't avoid it, pretty much everything.
Tell me exactly what Station Theater is, where it is, and kind of what the model of the company is.
Station Theater is located at 2219 Crockett Street. It's in the Sawyer Yards area, just south of Sawyer Street. It is an improv and sketch theater that's been around in Houston for quite some time. When I moved to Houston a couple of years ago, it was the theater that really spoke to me because of its dedication to inclusivity. You know, I've only seen the kind of diversity that we have at Station here and at Second City. And at Second City, it was because it was, you know, required. But here is just because it's genuinely... The mission of Station to create a space that's as safe as possible to as many people as possible. So if you need a warm and welcoming environment for comedy and theater, I mean, Station is the place to go.
You do the shows, but you also do classes for people that are interested in learning improv. And that may not be because they want to become performers, but because they want to add it to their repertoire of what they use in business.
Yeah, absolutely. We do have corporate classes. We do team building. And, you know, we make a lot of jokes about how improv is kind of a cult. You know, I never intended to get into improv. Somebody told me that, you know, improv will change your life. And I was like, yeah, okay, sure. And then I took an improv class, and it really just transformed everything for me. It improves your relationships because it teaches you how to be vulnerable and open and to take accountability for your choices. I mean, it changes your life in so many ways. I'm clearly a convert.
These shows that you have coming up on the 22nd and 29th, there for Pride Month. You have this title, The Supernova Storytelling and Improv, featuring Deborah Moncrief Bell.
Oh, wow. What a great guest. That's exciting. Yeah, No Suave is opening for us. They are a wonderful duo. And No Suave is taken from their last names. It's an amalgam of the two of them. They are amazing. Supernova this month is an all queer cast. And we have been rehearsing like crazy so that we can put on the best shows possible. We have amazing guests, yourself included, obviously, who really just represent the full diversity of the queer experience here in Houston. And I'm just so excited to get the word out about the amazing people we have, and just kind of show people how much fun and how much beauty there really is in queerness.
The press info says that the Supernova cast invites a special guest to tell true personal stories in a one-on-one interview format. Mm-hmm. Stories and discussions are then molded and reshaped into original improvised content. So what's likely to happen? What kind of thing might be asked of me that then will be transformed by this talented troupe?
We usually have a range of questions that kind of really delve into personal histories. I know that your experience is going to be more, I mean, everybody's queer experience is different, but we really wanted to know what it's like for you to have lived through so much of the queer movement. You know, we have a lot of voices in the community that are a lot louder now, but speak to a different experience that somebody over 40 would have. So, you know, there's definitely like a historical element for you, but also, you know, we know about your connection to the Montrose Center. We definitely want to hear about that. And your connection to queer voices. I mean, you are really kind of a paragon in the queer community in Houston. And we really want to delve into, you know, your story and what created that and prioritized it for you. And I mean, that goes for most of our performer or all of our guests, but especially for you, because, you know, your lived experience is so unique. Yeah, we just want to know more about it.
I'm way over 40. That's one thing. You're so right that the queer experience is everyone thinks of it like to be queer, it means this mm-hmm. or that. It can mean a lot of different things. I recently came across a quote that talks about queer not so much in terms of who you may be involved with sexually, but more about a different spirit. And I think that's one thing that happens with improv is that mm-hmm. the model, of course, is to throw something out and then say yes to it and then to build on it. Give me an example of something.
It was just kind of like when you tell somebody you're a comic and they're like, okay, tell me a joke. It would be like, you know, walking out on stage and being like, wow, I had, you know, a really hard day today. I really just want to, you know, sit down and stare at my frog. And maybe the other person decides they're going to come out and be that frog. And you just get to delve into the relationship between this person and their frog, or just kind of get that like window into life. And I mean, I think that's where the real beauty of improv lies, is in like the truth telling and the vulnerability, you know, those little reflections of daily life, because they say that, you know, the best part of comedy is when it's telling the truth, because that's when it's really relatable. And you know, that can look like a bunch of different things, but my favorite scenes are always the ones where you're like really delving into like an interpersonal relationship. When you're trying to be funny, it never works. But if you sit down and you have a kid and a dad, and one of them says they're not going to go to school today, and the dad's like, well, yeah, I never want to go to work either. You know, like we're at that point, we're delving into a reality that everybody relates to. Yeah. And I think that's really where we have the most potential to really create a difference and create beauty and kind of leave people feeling good about themselves and their realities and open up spaces for them to be who they are. Yeah, humans are just funny. You discover it just naturally by just existing.
How long have you been doing improv?
I've been doing improv since 2019. I started in Dallas. I thought that I was going to do stand-up because I'm just like I'm a punchy person. I've always got to have like the last word. And, you know, I had a crush on a girl who told me improv would change my life. And I was like, yeah, okay, sure, it will. And then I took a class and here I am.
Can you relate something that happened that just like, do you lose it? Do you crack up when?
Yes, all the time. In fact, Roger Anderson, who's one of the two owners, along with Jessica Brown of Station Theater, will have people in his classes ask him, like, what can I do, you know, to keep from breaking on stage? And he's like, I don't know. I mean, I still do it. He's been doing improv forever. And, you know, like, those are the best moments. Like, when something happens on stage and we just can't help but smile or laugh, like, I can't describe how good it feels as an improviser, but also as an audience member. Because as an audience member, when your performers are laughing, like, you get that break in the fourth wall. And, you know, it's like you're invited into this, like, even more intimate moment, because all of a sudden you're laughing with the performers. And it's like just kind of this beautiful synthesis of joy.
If someone comes to the Station Theater, are they likely to end up in the show?
Oh, generally not. I mean, we have a couple shows that do audience work. Nobody is ever forced to participate, but, you know, we'll ask for some word suggestions from the audience. We have a couple shows that will ask for audience stories or, you know, open participation from the audience. But, you know, we never force anybody to participate. We definitely want to keep some barriers between the audience and the stage. So we definitely don't want heckling or things like that. For the most part, it's just a warm, open environment where we focus on, you know, never punching down, never making anybody uncomfortable, if it can at all be avoided.
The first show is at 8 p.m. and then there's a second show at 9:30. Mm-hmm. And on the 22nd, the 9:30 show is the mental health happy hour. So mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about what the differences between these two shows might be.
So your 8 o'clock show, our Supernova, is going to be improv. The 29th, it'll be Four Night Stand, which is my improv troupe, followed by Supernova. All excellent shows, can't recommend them highly enough. And then on the 22nd, when you are our guest, we will follow that with Mental Health Happy Hour, which is a variety show. So you'll get some music, you'll get sketches, some improv. We're going to focus on short form improv, which is just a delightful treat. So instead of like building long stories, it's going to be more like, whose line is it anyway? Which, you know, is what a lot of people are familiar with when they think of improv. So it's just like fun, silly improv games. And it's just such a great show to bring joy to the audience. I started Mental Health Happy Hour a couple of years ago in Dallas after losing a friend who struggled with bipolar disorder. There's a group in Dallas called Foundation 45. That, you know, points out that creatives are much more likely to, we're much more likely to lose them to suicide, more likely to struggle with mental health issues. The same can be said of the queer community, as we know, especially when we have dangerous legislation that's taking place and threatening our community. I really wanted to be able to bring those together. We did a Mental Health Happy Hour last year for Pride, and it was such an amazing and moving show. We actually had telling stories about like our vulnerability, and then the audience would chime in afterwards with a "We still like you." And we had somebody in the audience who volunteered to tell a story, and it was, you know, this 13, 14-year-old trans girl who took the opportunity to come out to her family for the first time in this show because she knew that it was a safe and warm and welcoming space. And I mean, we just all cried because it was such a beautiful thing to be able to be a part of. And that kind of welcoming, warm, safe space is what we always want to be. And, you know, we want to hold as much space as possible for everyone to explore who they are and express who they are. Even if the world isn't always a safe space for us to be ourselves outside of the theater, inside the theater, we want to know who you are, because that's the person that we're going to love.
And we all know that laughter is great medicine. And the show on the 22nd actually benefits Grace Place. And then coming up on June 29th, you again have the Supernova storyteller, Sarah Laparina.
She's the owner of the Book Cycle, which is in the Third Ward. It is one of my favorite places in town. It is basically a big free bookstore. People can come and drop off donations of books. You can also come and take any book you want that's there.
So Sarah, she's a purveyor of words and a lover of creepy crawlies.
Yeah, Sarah's one of those people who has such a warm and big heart that she doesn't limit it to just things that are, you know, cute and adorable. Like, she has dogs. They're fantastic. You know, but she loves frogs and spiders and snails, and just extends that, like, love and adoration for the world and nature, and can find beauty everywhere. And it's truly admirable. And the Book Cycle is in the Third Ward because the Third Ward is a literacy desert, or was. We've had a lot of bookstores open in the last few years that are really kind of seeking to turn that around. I've given Sarah a hard time because there have been so many fascinating books at Book Cycle that I now have. It's caused me to reorganize my entire library, which is a little oppressive, but I love it. So we couldn't resist the opportunity to bring her in and let her talk more about this amazing nonprofit. She created it 12 years ago and has been running it on her own since then, with just herself and donations and volunteers. It's also such a safe space that, you know, we need more third spaces, need more safe spaces in our community, in our world. So we definitely want people to know that that's out there.
And then the 9:30 show is called Lesbi Honest, or Lesbi Honest. So I guess that's going to kind of be lesbian themed.
It's a woman loving woman sketch show. We do have some representation from some non-binary folks. We have some bi and pan representation. It's an hour of sketches about what it's like to be in love with women.
This is Deborah Moncrief Bell, and we've been talking to Elizabeth McCall from the Station Theater Company, which provides improv classes and shows, and they are featuring special shows during Pride Month every Saturday night. Thank you so much for being with us today on Queer Voices.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to talk about these opportunities.
This has been Queer Voices, which is now a home-produced podcast and available from several podcasting sources. Check our webpage, queervoices.org, for more information. Queer Voices executive producer is Brian Lavinka. Andrew Edmondson and Deborah Moncrief Bell are frequent contributors. The News Wrap segment is part of another podcast called This Way Out, which is produced in Los Angeles.
Some of the material in this program has been edited to improve clarity and runtime. This program does not endorse any political views or animal species. Views, opinions, and endorsements are those of the participants and the organizations they represent. In case of death, please discontinue use and discard remaining product.
For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Hi, I'm Francesca Rhiannon, the host of Writer's Voice, heard every Sunday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. on KPFT's HD2 channel. Tune in each week for in-depth conversation with writers of all genres about matters both timely and timeless. That's every Sunday morning, 8 to 9 a.m. on HD2, and remember to donate to kpft.org today.
Life in Houston is filled with options. You could do something different every night for a year and never run out of music, theater, films, or restaurants. How to decide? We can help. KPFT is a rich resource for community, culture, and cuisine. Son Pacifica keeps you current on the latest Latino films, theater, restaurants, and books. Howlin' the Blues connects you to the city's live music scene. And our weekly Living Art broadcast features local artists and events you might not discover otherwise. These are just a few of the many programs that will help you make the most of your city, even on nights when you're staying in. And small donations from listeners like you make it all possible. Become a member today. Call us or text GIVE to 713-526-5738 or go to kpft.org and hit the donate button. We're Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT.
One way to take a break from the news about COVID-19 is to listen to the music on KPFT. If you're holding back on making a donation because it's not the right time, you can always donate a vehicle you no longer need. Pickup is free, and the sale could mean hundreds of dollars of support. Learn more at kpft.org.